Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and this morning's conversation with Steve Att, Chief Financial Officer of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Joining us in our conversation is Dennis Kayser. Well, Steve, let's talk more about the FDIC programs areas. And as I understand it, they're insurance, supervision, and receivership management. Let's start with deposit insurance. Could you tell us how that works?
I'll tell you two parts about it. One, the coverage itself. It's basically $100,000 for a depositor at an institution, although there are some nuances about single ownership, joint ownership, retirement accounts, and even trust accounts. And we would ask the listeners to go to our website, www.fdic.gov. In the consumer area, we have a tool called EDI, which stands for Electronic Deposit Insurance Estimator, that can help you walk through some of the nuances. But basically, it's $100,000 at a particular institution for a depositor. And if you went to another institution, you'd have another $100,000. But with that, everybody, I think, goes into the banks and they see the plaque on the wall, $100,000, and they kind of take that for granted. And while it's very unlikely that the bank will fail or be placed in the receivership, our guarantee of protection, if it does happen, becomes very real to people. And we just want to let all the listeners know, rest assured, that the staff works day and night if a bank does get placed into receivership so that you have access to your insured deposits, hopefully by the very next business day. Our goal usually is to find a local bank that can take over the insured deposits so that when the closed bank reopens as a branch, the acquiring bank, there's basically no interruption in the service for the closed bank's insured depositors. If you have a loan with the closed banks, you would normally continue to make those payments, and oftentimes the local bank has taken over the insured deposit servicing of your loan as well. In the case that we're unable to find a local bank to take over the insured deposits, our staff works to give you your insured deposits by mail within a day or two. We kind of pride ourselves that within 48 hours, you'll get your insured deposits back. In each case, the goal is to make the process as smooth as possible so the fail bank's customers continue with their lives uninterrupted. Now, we work hard at customer service and make every effort to provide people with the money and access to their funds, again, usually within 48 hours.
Steve, you mentioned that the financial institutions or banks don't fail often, but are you able to describe a scenario where an institution did fail and what kind of assistance the FDIC actually provided?
Protecting the hard-earned money of Americans when a bank fails is one of the more rewarding aspects of what we do. And despite the fact that there haven't been a lot of failures in the seven-year history, we have never gone a year without seeing at least one bank failure. Again, in all that time, no one has lost their money. As I mentioned, in the vast majority of cases, we can find a healthy bank and they can take over the assets and leave the bad ones behind for us to dispose of, and that goes fairly rapidly. It's kind of amazing when you think about how quickly you can shut down a bank and start it up again in that process. Checks continue to clear, and it's business as usual for the customers. Another thing to point out, though, is that the FDIC doesn't actually close the bank. It's the chartering authority, so it could either be the states where the OCC or the OTS would actually close the bank, and then we would be named as the receiver of that bank. An example I think that kind of brings it home is a bank that failed earlier this year, Dollar Savings Bank in New York, Small Thrift in New Jersey. And here's an example of protecting the depositors. That bank also had a number of elderly customers that lived in several of the nursing centers around the bank. And since no bank came forward to take over the dollar savings assets, we tried to get the money into the hands of the people as quickly as possible. Our closing team took it upon themselves to basically hand deliver the checks to the elderly people in the nearby nursing homes, and the other checks were mailed within a day or so. So the bank failed on a Saturday, and by Monday the checks were either in the mail or being hand delivered to these elderly citizens.
Well, that sounds like a pretty amazing feat to pull off. The second program area that was mentioned was financial supervision. What financial institutions does the FDIC actually supervise?
As I mentioned earlier, the FDIC is the primary regulator for all state-chartered non-member banks of the Federal Reserve System and the savings banks that are not regulated by OTS. This represents about 5,300 banks out of about 9,200 institutions in the country. So we actually supervise about 58% of all the banks and financial institutions in the country. And from an asset base, that's about $1.7 trillion in assets, or about 19% of all the assets. The other banks are supervised, as I think I mentioned earlier, by OCC and OTS in close cooperation with us. The current structure of the four different federal banking regulatory agencies is a result of sort of evolving legislative framework and also the dual banking system with state and national banks. And it's kind of unique to the financial system of the United States. A lot of people ask, how did we get here? What were the major factors that led to this structure? Clearly, deposit insurance is one of those, since we insure all of those institutions. The role of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, looking at holding companies and other things that affect monetary policy and interest rates. And then the complexity of the dual banking system with states and national charters and things that overlap. And you have the holding company regulation. So each agency, while we do similar type work, we have our own sort of unique roles and responsibilities depending on how the institution was chartered and how it operates. Many have acknowledged that the current financial institution regulatory system is not a system that you would really design from scratch. Some folks say it works in all its convoluted glory. But the current system has endured, and the multiple agencies do provide alternative charter choices and comprise the so-called dual banking system. And again, the differences between the regulators are minor, but those that exist provide some competition and differentiation, and it's produced a very healthy banking climate, again, for the banks in the United States, some of the healthiest in the world.
So when supervising these banks, are there some financial indicators that the FDIC looks for to determine if an institution is safe and sound?
All the regulators use sort of a uniform rating system, which is called the CAMELS rating system. And CAMELS stands for capital, asset quality, management, earnings, liquidity, and rate sensitivity to market conditions. Those are sort of the Bible, the CAMELS ratings, the six factors that we mentioned. I'll just touch on a few of the items underneath those. And again, we go into banks every 12 to 18 months, depending on the risk conditions. So there's an on-site presence to look at these different factors when we go in there. We also share some of the exam functions with the state examiners and do some joint exams and alternate with those. But in terms of capital, bank capital, many people feel is one of the primary things that is almost a shock absorber to the system. So if you have losses or other unforeseen events, good solid capital is what can kind of save the bank and helps protect depositors. And in many cases, we don't have to go in if you have good, strong capital. Asset quality, of course, is another thing we look at. Problem assets, assets with non-accruing and non-performing delinquent loans, off-balance sheet commitments, things like that, securities portfolios. So the quality of the assets is important. Management, somewhat intuitive, but more and more now, especially with Sarbanes-Oxley and some things, integrity of the management, competence of the management, and in many cases, the experience of the management all kind of goes into the rating. When you get down from asset quality, you look at, do those assets actually produce the earnings? So return on assets is a sort of a benchmark that's used throughout the industry, and you can just pretty much rattle off the term ROA of 1-point-something and kind of know how the banking industry is doing. It's been doing very well, beating some of the historical benchmarks. And the ability to maintain your capital ratios, which is an important factor of capital based on your earnings stream. Liquidity, you're looking at sort of the trend and the stability of deposits, securitization activities, and are your sources of funding stable or volatile? How quickly could you convert some of these assets to cash? Rate sensitivity is really interest rates, maturities of both fixed and variable rate assets and liabilities, and that's sort of a newer addition, but that's the CAMELS kind of uniform rating system that we use, and that kind of determines the risk level of the banks.
The third program area of the FDIC was receivership management. Can you tell us more about this activity and what the FDIC does as a receiver?
Receivership management is where we take over the assets of the bank, and after we, in essence, provide all the insured depositors with 100% of their money, we then look to try to recover as much as we can with the rest of the assets to take care of the uninsured depositors and some of the other creditors. Just to give you a general sense of that, on average, we return over 80 cents on the dollar, which is pretty remarkable also for the banks for the sale of the assets and the liquidation. We return these proceeds as we go through the process. We've streamlined the process quite a bit. In the old days, some of the receivership activity could take as long as 9 years. We challenge ourselves now to wrap it up as fast as possible, on average 3 years or less, so it's been a remarkable achievement. And I think that the big thing is that since I've been at the FDIC, I've been impressed with the innovations that they've used to accomplish these goals. 15 years ago, largely paper-based, very labor-intensive to move these assets. We've leveraged technology. We have a proud history of innovation. A lot of that was forced by the S&L crisis. Just to give you some examples, during the late 80s and early 90s, nearly 2,950 banks and thrifts and $950 billion in assets failed. Combined, we had about an inventory of over $170 billion of assets to sell. Through that process, we developed innovative techniques such as asset securitization and innovative sales structures that really became a model for how the rest of the world could handle these things, and some of those innovations are with us today. We do a lot of things over the Internet now. We market a lot of these things over the Internet. We have sort of buyers and other people that are waiting when these things come available. They can look at them. So while there are fewer banks than there were during the S&L crisis, we think we're much more efficient at it. And as we go through that, we have a very competitive process now to market the assets sooner and get a better dollar return on investment.
That's interesting. It really cleared up a lot of the unknowns. The president's management agenda drives much of what's taking place in management of our government. How's the FDIC doing with the issues called out in the PMA? We'll ask Steve App of the FDIC to give us his perspective when the Business of Government Hour continues.